Hi, Katie.
Hello, Dom Dom. How's it going?
I'm fine. I've had a very busy week. I've been mainly rolling around on the floor with a group of 8 men.
Okay.
In a studio. And getting paid for it.
I feel like this week you've been working more than 24 hours a day, if that's possible.
Yeah, I'm trying to do too many things at once, I think. But yeah, it's been fun. I'm making theatre.
Why are you rolling around on the floor?
Oh, it was just workshops for a new dance piece I'm doing next year. Yes, I'm becoming a dancer, listeners. And yeah, it turns out it's quite fun.
I've been at a wedding this weekend, busting out some of my own moves. And I was quite confident in them at the time. And now I'm not so sure that they were the right moves. But I did them anyway.
You know what I learned this week?
What?
Nothing is a wrong move. Like, everything is valid, Katie.
Yes, I was expressing myself.
So, good for you. Has everything calmed down a bit in Paris?
It has a little bit. Obviously, it's been quite a difficult week because of the Strasbourg attack, which you'll have all read about. But I'm actually away. I'm in England this week. I'm having an early Christmas holiday because I have drawn the short straw and I'm working on Christmas Day. So, I will be back in Paris for Christmas. This week is family week and I've been in Nottingham for a wedding over the weekend. At which our jingle man, Jem Balm, was the best man. So I mentioned that you're after a new jingle and he said that that would be with you in the new year. So you have that to look forward to as your Christmas present.
Great. How exciting.
Very exciting.
So you have to work through Christmas, but the podcast isn't working through Christmas, is it? So this is actually our last episode of the year.
Yeah, can you believe it? 2018 is done, baby.
But don't cry, everyone, because we've got a good episode ahead. Still a good 25 minutes of you, of Katie chatting away to one of my favourite journalists. I'm very jealous. How was it?
While you were busy rolling around on the floor with 8 other men, I have been talking to Joris Luyendijk, a Dutch writer, one of our favourite tweeters on the continent, I think it's fair to say. So I had the pleasure of ringing up Joris to take stock of how things are going in Europe, really, at the end of 2018, and talking about all kinds of stuff. And it sucks to be you because you're at work instead.
Sad. Can't wait to hear it though.
That is coming up after.
Who has it been a good week for, Katie?
It's been a good week for me because I've learned how to say the name of Angela Merkel's successor at the head of her party, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer.
Oh my God, you are literally, not only have you spoken to Joris Luyendijk, but you've also learned how to say that. You're getting so ahead of me.
I've had such a productive week. But it's not even that like useful because everyone just calls her AKK because it is so long. A friend of the show, Deborah Cole, tweeted a quite funny placard against AKK and they tried to squeeze in the whole of her name. They kind of run out of space and they had to like squeeze the letters all the way around the side of the sign, which was quite funny. But yeah, everyone just calls her AKK. And indeed, AKK herself has had a very good week. As mentioned a few weeks back, Merkel has taken the huge decision to step down at the head of the party that she's been running for 18 years, the CDU, before stepping down as Chancellor in 2021, which set up a leadership race for the party. And this week it was AKK, sometimes known as Mini Merkel, because they're both pretty centrist and kind of low-key in their style, and also lazily because they're both women. AKK won that race. She beat off some quite stiff competition from 2 male rivals, and she is now the woman who will face the challenge of keeping Germany's governing coalition in power as Merkel prepares to bow out, which is no mean feat. So, yeah, quite a massive moment in German politics and quite an emotional one. Like I said, Merkel's led this party for 18 years. It is the end of an era, and it's going to be quite exciting for Germany watchers to see what happens. So, who is AKK? Is it fair to dismiss her as a kind of carbon copy of Merkel? I think it's been quite easy for the media to call her a mini Merkel because they are both these powerful women, and that is still a rarity in German politics and sadly politics in most places. And because they're both kind of unpretentious in their style and because AKK has promised continuity in her policy. But I think it is fair to say that AKK is more socially conservative than Merkel. She's pretty Catholic. She was very against gay marriage before it was brought in. And she signalled that she might be tougher than Merkel on migration. But there are similarities. They're both very determined, both very powerful women. AKK has had 3 kids, and it's her husband who's been the stay-at-home dad while her political career has taken off. And it's actually been really interesting to see her talk about that in the campaign for the leadership over the past few weeks. under these lazy labels that we as the media tend to apply to candidates, they all got given one of these. So Friedrich Merz was like the millionaire candidate, and Jens Spahn was the gay male candidate, and AKK was labelled the mother of three. And I actually wanted to play a translated clip of her talking about that from Stammtisch, which is a really excellent podcast about Germany, which we've talked about a little bit before on the show. They just did a full episode about AKK, which you should definitely check out if you want to find out more about her. Here is AKK talking about how she gets labelled as a mother of three.
When I started in politics and I had three small children, I was asked, what will happen to your children if you get into parliament? My male colleagues who sat next to me in parliament, who also had three small children, never had to put up with this question. I've never heard anyone say, oh yes, for our image we could do with a man now, or maybe a man from the West or whatever it might be, as if as a woman I was part of some sort of minority in this country that needed to be pitied. I would like to make it clear here that we make up more than half of the population.
See you nodding away there, Michaela.
It will resonate with a lot of professional women having those conversations where you get asked, oh, what do you do with your children? You're like, did you ask my male colleague that who was here 10 minutes ago? I don't think so.
Ooh, I will actually listen to the whole of that episode.
It's really good.
I mean, whilst your introduction's been like very enlightening.
Thank you.
You've tickled my fancy and I would like to hear more.
Sounds very exciting after a week of rolling around on the floor with eight men. It's AKK that gets you going. No, it's great. It's full of like little nuggets about her. So do check that out. Here's to you, AKK. You've got big shoes to fill, but I think it's going to be really interesting to see what she does next. Who's had a bad week?
It has been a bad week for Russian state TV, a channel known as Russia 24. The channel either accidentally or on purpose, or perhaps accidentally on purpose, broadcast footage of a so-called high-tech robot dancing on stage at a youth technology forum, only for it to be uncovered by some clever bloggers that the robot was in fact a human man wearing a robot costume.
Oh no.
One of the giveaways was that people noticed that the robot was making some unnecessary movements when it was dancing. And of course, everyone knows that if a robot dances, it will be totally efficient with all of its movements, and there'll be none of the unnecessary weird movements that Katie was doing at the wedding this weekend.
I was going to say, you just told me that all movements were valid.
Yeah, unless you're a robot. And that's what like differentiates robot dancers to human dancers like myself, Katie, that robot dancers don't have the art. The art is in the humanness, the inefficiency of it sometimes. I mean, that's what I say when I'm dancing anyway.
Okay.
Anyway, I enjoyed it in a kind of schadenfreude kind of way, because the fact that that's the reason, or one of the main reasons why people noticed it was a human, was it's like a really damning review of the actor dude who was in the robot costume.
Too human.
Because he was meant to be imitating a robot. He will have known that a robot should be like really efficient in its dancing. I mean, just doing the robot dance would have been enough. If only his dancing technique had been better, maybe people wouldn't have noticed.
Should have watched those Theresa May videos before he did it.
He should have. That would have been great inspiration.
Very good impression of a human doing a robot.
Yeah, she's great at that. Anyway, eventually, Putin opposing media outlet published a photo purporting to be the robot man, only half costumed. So that was seen as a slam dunk in this theory of it actually being a human. And the youth forum were forced to respond, saying that they weren't actually trying to pretend that the robot was real, which may be true, but the TV channel, either due to a mistake or in order to deliberately mislead viewers, they did present it as a real, all-dancing, all-speaking, high-tech robot.
Huh.
So it's a pretty bad week for the state media, either due to a boo-boo by an employee or by their own cunning deception. I guess we'll never know which one is true. So, yeah, I'm really jealous that Katie got to speak to Joris this week. Joris Leyendijk, he writes for The Guardian and The Correspondent, as well as appearing on Dutch television and writing books. I sound like really like, oh, I guess he does this, I guess he does that. I should sound a bit more upbeat and not sound so bitter.
He doesn't dance, though.
He doesn't dance, no. Not as far as I know. Maybe he does.
Not as far as we know.
Everyone dances, Katie. He writes very broadly. He was a correspondent in the Middle East for many years and then lived in the UK for a while and wrote a Guardian blog taking an anthropological look at bankers 10 years after the banking crisis. He also has a new podcast for our Dutch-speaking listeners called Goed Nieuws, is it?
I'm really glad that you said that because I was going to have a stab at it. But as you know, my Dutch is quite slecht.
Slecht.
That's what I said.
You said schlecht.
Whatever.
You're forgiven. You don't live here and you speak much better French than me and much better French than I speak Dutch. So I should not shame you for your language skills. So his new podcast is from The Correspondent, which is this pioneering Dutch startup news organization that you may have heard about, especially this week, because they just reached their funding goals to be able to launch in the English language in America.
Yeah, very exciting.
Yeah, they raised over $2.5 million just from donations from ordinary people like you and me. And they accept no advertising revenue. And yeah, he's been very involved in the creation of that organization. And he's also been talking a lot about why the public has lost faith in the media. And yeah, maybe Katie talked to him about all these things, but I don't know.
You weren't there.
No, I wasn't there. Yeah, as you keep reminding me. He writes a lot about the little covered political situation that is going on in the UK at the moment. But I'm sure you didn't talk about that, did you? Because of our B-word ban.
It was a bit the elephant in the room because Joris is following, obviously, the B-word situation very closely as a former resident of London who moved out of the country in part because of the B-word situation. So it might have come up a couple of times. As a really seasoned observer of Europe, I just kind of wanted to get his perspective on where we are in Europe at the end of 2018. And that was actually my starting point for this conversation. How he thinks we've done as a continent in 2018.
I think it's been far less bad than we got used to. The EU was at its worst when we were hit by three simultaneous crises. So the refugee waves, the terrorist attacks, and the Eurozone mess. And I think as long as we don't have a big new wave of refugees, no new gruesome waves of attack, and no necessary rescue package for the Euro, it sort of seems to bubble along. So just the absence of horror helps. And then, of course, the surrounding powers all look completely horrible. So just by default, we look better. So the Russians look terrible, the Turks look terrible, the Brits look absolutely ridiculous, and then they're the Americans. So yeah, in relative terms, it feels better and better to be European again.
That's funny. That's a lot more positive than I was expecting you to sound, because I know you've been recently named a bad news correspondent for De Correspondent, which is a Dutch media outlet. Can you explain that job title? It sounds very strange to a sort of English-speaking ear, maybe to a Dutch one.
Yeah, and that's its function. The idea is that on two levels. So one, I'm trying to analyze bad journalism, so news done badly.
Okay.
And at the same time, I'm trying to find an answer to the question, how do you get bad news, i.e. news that tells you something you don't want to hear about the world? How do you get that kind of information in the heads of people? Because a lot of people just click away as soon as you try to tell them, for example, about climate change or about the destruction of the ecosphere, but also about necessary steps to make the euro safe and that sort of thing. As journalists, we often hit on bad news as just bad stuff happening in the world. Mm-hmm. And then how do we get that to people? That's an increasingly difficult challenge with the emergence of the internet and the market logic, where you're rewarded for telling people what they want to hear rather than what they need to hear.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because I often feel that as a reporter, you know, especially in Paris at the moment, all I do is report on bad news. And all I've done for several years was report on terrorist attacks and migration and now these big protests that we're having. And I guess for me, it feels like the reason we focus on bad news so much is because things staying the same or sometimes getting better doesn't feel like news sometimes. It's kind of like everything is fine. You can't run that as a headline.
Yeah. I think that there's bad news, as in, for example, a terrorist attack or incidents of just horrible stuff happening. But the real bad news is that as human beings, we're destroying the very ecosphere that makes human life possible. That is actually far more important than the latest terrorist attack or even the Eurozone architecture. And yet, trying to get people interested in the destruction of the ecosphere that makes their own lives possible, and they just click away.
Yeah.
The climate people are really pissed at the terrorism reporters because they say, you know, how relevant is it that some loser blows himself up and kills a few other people compared to what's coming when all the insects are dying? And I'm in the Netherlands, you know, I'm talking to you from several meters under sea level.
Yeah. Have you found any answers to like how to do it?
No. Because as soon as I find the answers, I will share them with the rest of humanity.
Well, I really look forward to hearing them because, yeah, it's a tough one. You know, in Paris, last weekend, there was this massive climate march at the same time as the Gilets Jaunes. Did we write about it? Nowhere near as much as we talked about the protests. And there does seem to be an imbalance.
The lesson of the Gilets Jaunes is you need to use violence.
Yeah, because it works.
I think until the climate marchers begin to use serious violence, apparently, it just doesn't compute. But of course, I think using violence is so opposed to the ethos of those who are worried about climate destruction, that it's a very difficult thing. I don't think they put their heart in violence. Climate marches aren't violent. They're normal people.
Apart from maybe like some sort of fringe anti-capitalist people who maybe use violence. Yeah, I agree, the vast majority.
That's true. But that's France.
Yeah, this is the thing. I mean, violence has shown itself repeatedly to get attention in France and to work to some extent in getting the government's attention, at least. While we're on the subject, what do you think of the Gilets Jaunes protests spreading to the Netherlands a little bit?
Well, it didn't spill into the Netherlands at all. I mean, it was just negligent. But if you zoomed in and you never zoomed out, it looked big.
Uh-huh.
It was really nothing. The closest analogy with the Gilets Jaunes is the Occupy movement, which for a while was very attractive because it didn't define itself in any sort of way. And so everybody could project their own wishes onto it. But the absence of a leadership structure, the absence of organization, over time meant it disappeared. And then they didn't use violence.
Mm-hmm.
In a year's time, we'll look at each other and say, remember those yellow vests? Right, yeah.
I really hope you're right because I'm getting a bit bored of reporting on it all the time. But in a year's time, in terms of sort of the state of Europe, do you think we'll see Europe in a stronger position?
I worry that since now the sense of crisis has abated, that people just fall back on this sense of, all right, let's just muddle on and go back to business as usual. And the fact is that we're going to have to pay a lot of money, especially in the north, either to dismantle the euro or to finish it. Because right now we have this half-built house. And a half-built house is fine as long as the weather is nice, but at some point we'll have a storm, and then the whole thing comes crashing down. And so everybody's currently lying in Europe. The ones who want to dismantle the EU, they lie about the costs. The ones who want to just muddle on lie about the impossibility. That is just a recipe for disaster. And the ones, the federalists, who want to continue, finish the euro, the building of the euro, they lie about the necessity for the North to start funding and subsidizing the South. And so there's a short-term interest for all involved to deny the sacrifices necessary for their course of action. And in the absence of a functioning public sphere in Europe, it's very difficult to challenge any of these groups in a coherent way.
I know that you have a podcast for The Correspondent, and you recently interviewed the Europe correspondent. He really supports the idea of Europe, but he thinks the EU is like a bad embodiment of it. Do you agree with him on that?
I struggle. I don't really know whether I have a fully formed idea of the sort of the European idea or something. I think the starting point for journalists should be curiosity. So I struggle sometimes with Brussels-based European journalists who have sided with a particular camp, usually the federalist camp, or at least the European idea camp. I think this is one reason why some of their journalism is sometimes not as exciting as it could be, because the conclusion is already there. We need more Europe. And so it becomes almost hectoring and pedagogic.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you would cover it the way you cover, sports, you're just interested in whatever team is going to pull whatever sort of new tactic. I think that would be a much more engaging and interesting way.
It cannot be denied that a lot of European journalism is really boring and it is really tedious to follow these, like,
it's insufferable. And I'm like, how can you make this boring? I know it's technical and everything, but at the same time, this is the first time in history that we're building an empire based on consensus rather than conquest. And you've got 28 different national cultures in these institutions that are constantly evolving. It must be possible to write in an engaging way, but not if you project your own national perspective on it by pretending that there's a government, there's an opposition, and now there's a summit and there's a crisis, and now we're going to tell the readers back home what's the next step. Just like the EU is sui generis, it's a completely new thing. We need journalism that is sui generis about the EU in order to make it both relevant and accessible and interesting. Yeah, because right now it's just hopeless. They try to imagine how to do a West Wing or House of Cards about the EU.
That is an amazing idea.
It must be possible, because in the end, it affects lives in the same way. Decisions taken in Brussels mean life and death in the long run, you know, whether funds are allocated to one area or another, one field or another. And the games played there are really, really tough. I'm aching for journalism that is off Europe, that addresses issues that matter to me on the European level, not to replace the national, but as an addition, because I have a regional identity, a national identity, a global identity, and a continental identity. But for that continental identity, there's no one sort of giving voice to that.
I mean, we're trying in our own little way, but we're just a little podcast run out of two people's bedrooms in Amsterdam and Paris.
It's a start. I think it's really good you're doing this.
Thank you. We are trying.
Yeah.
And it's nice. You know, we get messages from people all over Europe saying, there's nothing like this. And thank you for helping me to feel European for half an hour every week, because it doesn't exist.
The next thing is that you can be European in different ways. Because right now, we're not offered alternatives within the EU. So we don't have a political conversation on what kind of EU do we want for ourselves. And so by default, the conversation is, are you in favor of the EU or against? So rather than alternatives within the EU, you are offered an alternative to the EU. We need not just to feel European, but also to define the different ways that you can feel European. Just like you can feel American, but Americans understand that there are different ways of feeling American. We really need to get past that utopian phase where the EU would be the end of politics and we would all become brothers. We're not, but we are. We do share a number of characteristics and we do share a number of interests, and we have built this thing to address these two.
I agree that we need somewhere to talk about it. I mean, I'm British. I grew up with a media that kind of treated Europe and the EU as something that was both distant and really boring as a kind of like matter of fact.
Yeah.
And there was no attempt to make it exciting or something that you should care about, really. And we are dealing with the consequences of that right now.
But it's still, the EU is often still as a kind of, just like their cultural vegetables, you know, eat your cultural vegetables, go to the museum. Is no way to get people to a museum, because you need to convince them that there's something interesting for you in the museum. And it's the same about the EU, is that so many decisions taken there directly affect my life. It's like on a national level, I want to know what my national politicians are doing. But it's either boring or sacred or sanctimonious. Also just some fun, I mean some humor.
Yeah.
Every now and then on Twitter you find good GIFs or sometimes some footage, and then they subtitle it with imagined subtitles. For example, this week about Theresa May and Jean-Claude Juncker about the word nebulous. And so I think we're beginning to get a little bit of that. But we also need some showbiz around it.
Which might happen, you never know. I mean, Netflix is making more European shows at the moment. It could happen.
Yeah.
Dominic said that you were doing some lectures about why people kind of don't trust the media.
I wrote a book 12 years ago about what it's like to be a correspondent in the Middle East and how correspondents really work rather than how they like to pretend they work. And the message was essentially, don't believe everything you see. So 12 years on, that has morphed almost in stop believing anything you see. So we've gone from naivety to paralyzing distrust. My talk is about how do you maintain a healthy skeptical attitude without falling either in the trap of naivety and believing anything you hear, or in the trap of distrust where you believe nothing. And I think that the Brexit referendum was a really interesting mixture of two. So on the one hand, people decided they wouldn't believe any expert any longer. So even if 99% of people who knew what they were talking about said one thing, the majority of the electorate still went the other way. That was distrust. But there was also naivety when the tabloids and the billionaire owned newspapers just fed people the sort of lines that people like to be fed. My talk is very much about how do you stay away from information chaos, but also from naivety.
Information chaos has obviously been an issue in my country, Britain, in the run-up to Brexit. Is it a problem in the Netherlands as well, particularly?
Not really. The great thing, and Herman Hesse, the German thinker, once said, if the world is destroyed, I'm moving to Holland, because there everything happens 50 years later. We still have fantastic high levels of trust. Our main quality newspaper, NRC Handelsblad, just had its most profitable year in its history, and it's more than 150 years old. Our media landscape is quite different, but of course, the Dutch speak English very well, and so they get a lot of misinformation, especially now from the British, but also from the Americans and generally from troll factories. So the threat is there, and over time the threat will develop and develop, because there's just, as a tool for geopolitical politics, the misinformation is very, very powerful, and it's especially powerful against open societies like ours.
So it is starting to seep in. That's worrying. I know you lived in Britain for many years, and you moved back, I think, to the Netherlands, at least in part because of Brexit. I just kind of wanted to ask you how Brexit has changed the way that you feel about Britain, this country that you did kind of call home for many years.
Yeah, I lived there for 6 years. And it was over time that I began to realize, like, I thought I was moving in with my cousins, but I keep hearing, no, we're not family. We can be friends, but we're not family. We're not Europeans. And Europe is in many quarters, and I mean, I worked for The Guardian, it was a pejorative term. You know, okay, we may be, the trains are terrible and the food is horrible and the weather is horrible, but at least we're not Europe. And there were quite high-ranking journalists I met who were supposedly on the left who told me, like, yeah, but the EU, you know, it's Germany's attempt to win World War II with other means. Mm-hmm. And I found that if I, at dinner parties or something, if I wanted to ingratiate myself with the hosts, and they could be anywhere across the political spectrum, what I needed to do is I needed to cut down the EU, and especially Germany as the perennial other. And over time, I began to realize that actually I've looked at Britain through rose-tinted glasses. I thought Britain, that's Monty Python, that's J.K. Rowling, that's Stephen Fry. You have those sort of people, but they're not dominant. Dominant is the guy from Auto Gear. What's his name?
Jeremy Clarkson.
You said it. Jeremy Clarkson. And Piers Morgan, and those sort of people. And so add to that 30 years of brainwashing and a lost empire complex with debilitating withdrawal symptoms, and such a mixture of hostility and ignorance about Europe, a bit like a man who still believes he's very popular with the ladies. And you go, like, that's painful. You know, you're 59. You still have lots of qualities, but that's not it. You're no longer among the top dogs. Yeah. That has been internalized across Europe so much, even in France, I find, so much more deeply than in Britain. It's the main argument for the EU, the simplest, is simply, you know, there are two kinds of countries in Europe, small countries and countries still in denial over the fact that they're small. And individually, in tomorrow's world, we're a few percent of the world population. If we stick together, we probably will maintain our sovereignty over our own continent. But if we split up, we're nothing. To say that out loud in Britain was almost treason.
That's not a great picture of this country of mine that you're painting, but is there anything that you miss about Britain?
Yeah, I thought the sense of humor. If France had folded itself out of the EU, it would have been very grim and very ugly and very boring. The sort of jokes that came out of England, I mean, the ability to laugh at yourself, that to me is quintessentially English. I just wish the English created fewer reasons to laugh at themselves.
I'm thinking of giving myself a little pat on the back because I've got a genuinely happy ending once again this week.
Good to know. Let's hear it.
Did you hear that? It was me patting myself on the back.
Oh, sounds dangerous.
Dangerous.
Painful.
I think most people know by now that bees are really very important for the world, right?
Bees?
Bees, yeah.
Yes, we need bees.
Yeah, we do. Okay, well, just in case you've forgotten, according to some UN-backed research, some $577 billion of food are dependent on pollinators, of which bees are the most important. That's a lot of food that wouldn't exist if it weren't for bees. As pollinator numbers are declining, some are trying to replace the pollination process by hand. This is obviously very difficult and laborious, and something that nature should give us for free, and kind of still does, but just in smaller quantities than it used to. So why are bees dying so rapidly? Well, a lot of it is due to insecticides and nasty chemicals that are put on our crops, but the decline isn't only due to insecticides. Disease also plays an important factor, along with fungus, viruses, and mites. It is thought that some combination of these factors is causing this thing known as colony collapse disorder. The phenomenon that occurs when the majority of worker bees in a colony disappear and leave behind a queen, plenty of food, and a few nurse bees to care for the remaining sad, immature bees.
Oh, God.
I'm saying they're sad, and I shouldn't do that because that's putting it in a human context, and They probably don't feel sad.
It's just anthropomorphized, whatever that word is, the bees, and I'm starting to tear up a bit.
Anthropomorphizing them. Yeah, well, maybe that's what we need in order to care about these things. Anyway, some scientists at the Helsinki University in Finland have been trying to work out how to help the poor honeybees, and they think they found an answer that will help with at least some of the drop-off. They have developed a vaccine against a very serious disease that is affecting the bee community. Until relatively recently, it was thought that it was impossible to vaccinate insects, but they seem to be finding a way to do it with these bees. The treatment is given to the queen bee in a sugar pill, just like when you have your polio pill as a child.
Oh, yeah.
And she then passes on the immunity to her offspring.
Wow. Oh, because she has all the babies.
She has all of the babies. She's the queen bee.
Oh, got it.
They are hoping that it could help stem the drop in population, even just a little bit. And even a little bit would make a huge difference. Mm. Dalial Freitag, one of the researchers, said of her discovery, "If we can help honeybees to be healthier, and if we can save even a small part of the bee population with this invention, I think we have done our good deed and saved the world a little bit."
That's really nice.
Merry Christmas, everyone, and every bee.
We're actually doing our bit at my office in Paris to try and bring the bee population back up. We've got hives on the roof.
That's so cool.
It's really cool. And my boss, Fabien, is like in the beekeeping team. And he has to go up to the roof every so often in one of those white suits. And this year we got our first pots of honey from our company bees. And it was really cool. You can sort of mildly taste the hint of central Paris pollution in the honey. But you can't actually. It's just really nice honey. But it is a bit weird thinking like, huh, we work in one of the busiest neighbourhoods in Paris, and that's what we're eating. Yum, yum.
That's cool. We were thinking about getting one on our roof terrace at home, but I'm a bit squeamish about the idea of having bees on the roof terrace right by my bed.
I just feel like you're quite clumsy, and I can just see you like knocking something over and all the bees going everywhere. Just being really disastrous, no offence.
Does everyone think I'm clumsy?
But after your skiing accident this year, isn't that fair?
I was doing really well. The reason why I had a skiing accident was because the teacher told me I was doing a really good job and I was a natural.
You were just too good, Dominic.
Yeah, that's why I broke my shoulder.
Okay. Anyway, we've got to go because you are yourself a very busy bee and have to head off to the cinema now. So that's it for another week of the Europeans and indeed our first full year. What an amazing year it's been. We have talked to amazing people and had really just like countless lovely messages from everyone everywhere from Germany to Israel. So we just want to give you all a big thank you for making this all worth doing. We're going to be away till January now, but we're still going to be all over the internet, so I don't think you're going to miss us too much.
You can hit us up on Twitter at EuropeansPod. You can email us europeanspodcast@gmail.com, or you can find us on Instagram, EuropeansPodcast. Oh, and Facebook, which I always forget about.
Poor Facebook.
The Europeans Podcast. And do like send us any ideas you've got. Again, we love it when we get ideas from people. We're going to obviously be thinking about the show a lot.
Stuff for the new year.
If you've got any ideas for stories or people you think we should be speaking to, then let us know. We'd love to hear from you.
Have a brilliant festive period whenever and whatever you're celebrating, and a very happy new year, and we will see you all in 2019.
Happy new year, everyone.
Bye.